Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with the first Slate spoiler special of 2012. Joining me in the Slate studios is John Swansburg.
Good morning.
Hello, John. You're the culture editor for Slate.
I am.
And you are joining me to talk about Haywire, the new Steven Soderbergh action thriller, would you call it?
Yeah, action thriller.
So Steven Soderbergh, I guess, has this expression, one for me, one for them, having to do with his incredibly prolific career and how he essentially makes a movie to make money, one of his Ocean's 11 movies or something big budget, an action-type movie, and then makes something for himself, which can get as weird as his Kafka movie starring Jeremy Irons.
Right, or Bubble, where he shot a movie all in digital and used non-actors. And
like The Girlfriend Experience,
The
recent movie he made starring the porn star Sacha Grey.
Right.
So would you consider this a one for him or a one for everybody else?
It's weird. I feel like this one, in a way, straddles the line because it feels slightly low budget in some ways, or maybe it's more just that it felt sort of slapdash. But it also it's an action movie. It seems to be made to be a crowd pleaser. So in that sense, it feels like a kind of more of a Hollywood style movie. But it's not nearly as like glitzy or star studded or slick as the Ocean's movies. Say.
Yeah, there's something very odd about this movie's approach that I can't figure out whether it's deliberate or not. I feel like if and when I say this in my review, defenders of Soderbergh in this movie are going to pop up and say, but all that was deliberate.
Right.
And I can't be sure that they weren't right, because I feel like he's so knowledgeable about film. He's such a sophisticated filmmaker in terms of the techniques he can master and the different voices he can take on and kind of what a shapeshifter he is, that, you know, people can just say, well, he's trying to make a schlocky action blockbuster. But to me, this was just a little bit too schlocky below the line. Well, the big stick of this movie that you have to know about going in is that it stars this woman, Gina Carano, who's a mixed martial arts star,
right,
and has never acted before. So like Sacha Grey, the porn star in Girlfriend Experience, he's building a movie around this beautiful, mysterious non-actor who doesn't necessarily have the thespian chops to carry it off.
Well, Sacha Grey had acted before, just in a different style of movie.
Yeah, it's true. It's actually not even analogous, because Sacha Grey had obviously been
in front of a camera.
Right.
Yeah.
In front of a camera in a much more vulnerable state than we even see her in the Girlfriend Experience.
Right, right. Gina Carano is truly someone who's never acted, and I felt like it really showed. I felt like she was her lack of experience and her inability to kind of hold a scene really was a drag on the movie. And I had just to go back to what you were saying before, I had the same exact reaction to you, which was that I was sitting in the movie theater thinking to myself, and this was also, I was distracted from the action and the complicated plot by these thoughts. I was wondering, is this a joke that I'm not getting? Like, is there, or is Soderbergh mimicking something or sort of taking on a style that I don't really understand or know well enough to get why this is good? I was sitting in a room of film critics wondering, like, I wonder if the people next to me are enjoying this on a different level because they realize what Soderbergh's doing, and I'm sitting here not realizing what he's doing and just watching a movie that feels like just not very well put together and not very engaging and not full of the good performances that I often associate with Soderbergh movies, even Soderbergh movies that are shot with actors who are not necessarily great actors. I mean, one of my favorite movies of all time is a Soderbergh movie, Out of Sight, and I've never seen Jennifer Lopez act the way she did in that movie. I think he's often very good at teasing out good performances from people you wouldn't expect them to come from, but I was totally distracted throughout the movie by Carano's lack of ability.
Right. I mean, there's just a huge gulf between her physical abilities and her kind of her mental, emotional telegraphing abilities, right? Like when it's her body in action, she's pretty amazing. And it is great, especially in the early scenes when suddenly, you know, to your complete surprise, you know, in walks a stranger and suddenly there's a big slugging match and she is completely holding her own. She's a really big, powerful woman and she's really beautiful and has an incredible body, right?
Right.
And not the kind of body you usually see on screen, like really, really muscular and large, right?
Right.
But that, to me, that kind of wore on me, given the fact that anytime we're looking at her face or listening to her voice, things are just not that interesting.
Yeah, and there's actually more of this movie this movie spends more time with her face and her emotions than I maybe expected it to. When I read about it and I learned about the idea of casting this person who wasn't an actor but was an MMA star, I sort of assumed it would be more chock full of action. But there are actually a good number of scenes where we're kind of looking at her face, or where she's at a kind of weird dinner party and trying to act like she's someone she's not. And there's a lot of downtime where she's not kicking ass, and those scenes don't play to her strengths by any means.
Yeah, I think the idea is supposed to be that she's this sort of Steve McQueen, like, you know, impassive mask behind which all these complicated things are going on. But she's just not charismatic enough to pull those off. I mean, for all I know, she is having a complex inner life behind that face. But it is just not – it's not coming through. It's just dull to watch.
Impassive is, sort of a euphemistic way of saying that she's not very good at acting, I think. But, you know, that would be, the charitable way of describing it. So should we briefly talk about the plot?
Yeah, let's try to get through the story. I'm not even sure that I can – it doesn't really matter if you follow every detail of the story. But it is sort of fun to try to find your way through this complicated plot, because the movie itself at times makes a joke out of, you know, how complicated this this whole international murder rescue plot is, and how nobody in the movie seems to know what's going on.
Right. So I saw the movie a week before you did, and I find myself really grappling with the details and trying to figure out what happened. But let me see if I can nail the basics. So Gina Carano plays a woman named Mallory, who's sort of a black ops specialist. You know, she's essentially an assassin, like a CIA style assassin, who can be dispatched into difficult situations to either kill someone or maybe, you know, extricate someone who's been taken hostage. But she doesn't work for the U.S. government. She works for a private contractor, and the her boss is Ewan McGregor, and he sort of runs this kind of small black ops private contracting company that specializes in this kind of extraction and assassination. And their company is hired by Michael Douglas, who I believe works for the U.S. government, although we don't have any sense of what branch, whether he's works for the CIA or some other or the Department of Defense.
Right. There's no contextualization of who he is, but he sits in front of a flag all the time. So
exactly.
We know he's in Washington.
That's the only
somewhere.
Tip. Yeah, he sits in front of a flag. For all we know, he's a private guy who just likes flags. But I think it's pretty clear that he works for the government. The government hires Ewan McGregor's firm to do a mission, and they specifically ask for Mallory to do it. And I don't know why that was, because they knew she was good or for some other reason. But they remember that scene where he's like, "We really want Mallory to do it," and that sort of was one detail among many that I didn't quite ever.
Oh, I
grasp.
Thought it was just basically this kind of superhero argument, like we want her because she's the best and she's the only one who can do it.
Yeah, yeah. At the beginning, I thought maybe they wanted to frame her, or they felt like she was she was more expendable than someone else. I don't know. I was maybe overthinking it. But so do you want to try to describe what the mission actually is? Because that
yeah,
gets
it
even
seems
more
like if I grasped it right. So Antonio Banderas, who has this kind of big gray beard in this part, I actually think Antonio Banderas is really funny in this small part that he has. But he's this evil.
And he looks great in a beard.
Yeah, he does. He looks fantastic. At first, it was hard to tell that it was him. He does shave it later on. So Banderas contracts Ewan McGregor and Michael Douglas together in a government black ops combined operation to kidnap this dissident Chinese journalist, right? And there's a big action scene at the beginning where this guy is captured in Barcelona. And what we find out much later, at the very end of the movie, is the big reveal is that he actually wanted to kill the journalist all along. But I think because Mallory's a good person, right? She wants to work for the good guys. They couldn't have gotten her to just kill someone for hire.
Right.
So instead they disguise it as we're trying to save this guy from captivity. She does the big operation. And then how does the Chinese journalist die?
He dies
in the
later.
Course of the operation?
No. Remember, they successfully extract him and hand him over, I think, although I think this happens off screen, they hand him over to, you know, whoever, like Banderas' people, assuming that they're going to liberate this Chinese dissident journalist. But later, when essentially after that, either Banderas or McGregor decides they basically need to kill Mallory.
Is that just because she knows too much? I don't know why they decide to kill her.
I don't know. Yeah, I think it must be that she knows too much. They decide that having participated in that dirty deal, like she needs to go. So they set up this second kind of elaborate thing where she thinks she's just going on a sort of relatively simple mission to England, I think, to pose as the girlfriend of this other guy, this other kind of black ops guy, who Ewan McGregor is trying to woo to join.
Who's played by Michael Fassbender,
and when they go to sort of like a country house in Britain for a cocktail party, and she finds the dissident journalist like in the stables with a bullet through his head. Remember?
Right. So then she discovers the truth of her prior operation and starts to suspect that this whole Michael Fassbender setup is essentially just a way to get her out of the way.
And also, I think I might be wrong about this, but I think that the McGregor plot or plan was to kill Mallory and frame her for the murder of the Chinese dissident, because when she finds him, he's grasping a brooch that is the same brooch that McGregor has given her to wear on her
so that Fassbender
lapel.
Knows who she is.
Yeah,
right.
So I thought that was what that meant, but it was like one of these details, and there are several in the movie that they go by so fast that you don't really have time to process what they mean exactly. I like sort of figured that out like four scenes after it was it had already passed, and it kind of didn't matter.
Yeah, that brooch detail didn't occur to me. But of course, in the course of the movie, none of this is clear now. I mean, part of the reason we're having trouble putting it together is that while it's all unfolding, all that's happening is a lot of action in different cities, and you don't get quite what's tying it all together.
Right.
And then when necessary, somebody launches into a clumsy exposition of this that then turns into an extended flashback. That happens a couple different times during
the movie. And as you said before, I mean, this is punctuated by moments of excitement. So, you know, Mallory kind of puts it together over the course of the dinner party or whatever it is in the country house in Britain that she is the target for that mission. That Fassbender is going to take her out. So then they have this like protracted fight.
That's my favorite action scene in the movie. When Michael Fassbender and her have it out in the hotel room after having posed essentially as husband and wife or boyfriend and girlfriend all day, it's great because it's sort of a big joke on the way that fight scenes kind of mimic sex scenes, right? And that a fight between a man and a woman can also be this kind of crazy erotic battle. And of course, they're both very sexy people.
Yeah.
So that's actually a really great isolated scene, even though we essentially have no idea who these characters are or what's going on.
Right. But for the dead body that the maid finds the next day in that hotel room, it might have just looked like crazy sex had happened in that hotel room with all the like broken glass and like, you know, bedding everywhere. That fight scene was the best. Although I'd like to say that although the fight scenes are great, there are other sort of action scenes in this movie that I thought were not as great. And I don't think it's right to say that sort of the exposition scenes or the scenes where Carano is not fighting are bad and the action scenes are good. There are actually some action scenes that I thought were kind of goofy. And the one that really stuck in my craw was shortly after she dispenses with Fassbender, she's kind of on the run from – she knows she's going to be followed.
Oh, the rooftop chase, right?
Yeah, there's a rooftop chase. So it's like she basically is cornered by, I guess, the Irish – like an Irish – series of Irish SWAT teams. There are like 40 police officers and like full on, you know, SWAT gear kind of trying to hunt her down. And she's sort of running around the streets of Dublin. And I guess the country house was in Ireland. So anyway, she's in Dublin and she's being chased. And they basically have her cornered. She goes upstairs in a building. She makes her way onto the roof. She's like running around the rooftop. She sort of fights a couple guys. And you're like, how's she going to escape? Ultimately, she like makes her way down into a garage where she finds a car. And inside the car is a green hooded sweatshirt that says Trinity on it. Now, what this you know international mass you know Black Ops mastermind does is she dons said hoodie, puts the hood up, walks out into the street, and is not recognized by like four police officers who see her.
I knew you were going to have a problem with that because before I saw the movie, you just said, "Oh God, there's a detail involving a green hoodie that is just so bogus." And so I was waiting the whole time for the green hoodie.
It doesn't make any sense. Like, you know, if all she needed was a sweatshirt to escape, meanwhile she's like broken the necks of like four police officers. She's been running around, you know, playing this cat and mouse game with all these SWAT teams, and then you know, all she lacked was the appropriate sweatwear, and she makes her escape, which is like such a letdown after that extended – it was a pretty long chase scene.
No, you're right. It was almost as if the screenwriter just gave up on getting her out of it and just said, you know, let's just pick the most random disguise possible. I mean, she might as well have just – a pillowcase over her head would have been a better disguise.
I guess if you wanted to be – again, if you wanted to be charitable, you could say, well, like maybe they – you know, once she puts a sweatshirt on, she does just look like this, you know, woman who's like out for her job.
Did they know they were chasing a woman the whole time?
I thought they did. I mean, but there was – it wasn't – you could have played that up like, oh, she looks like a woman. She can't, you know, can't possibly be what the person we're after. But it really was just sort of like, oh, that person with the, you know, that person wearing a hoodie, you know, let's not pay attention to her. We're looking for a woman who's not wearing a hoodie. How could she have access to a hoodie? It didn't make any sense at all.
So it's also worth mentioning that this is all framed by a frame story in which she is driving madly around New Mexico, I believe, the New Mexico countryside?
She's in upstate New York.
Okay, there is a New Mexico scene later,
that's later
too. But yeah. The initial chase begins in this upstate New York diner where she comes in the green hoodie, actually, orders a cup of coffee or something, and then Channing Tatum, who's a fellow operative, right, guy who worked with her on the Barcelona job, comes in, sits down. You think that they're either boyfriend and girlfriend or ex-colleagues, and they're going to have some kind of a reconciliation. Instead, he suddenly throws a pot of coffee in her face, and they get into this huge brawl. And that's the first moment that you realize, oh, this woman is this incredible fighter, right? That scene ends with her essentially carjacking the car of a guy, just a random fellow who happened to be at the diner, not Channing Tatum, and taking him on this crazy joyride, expositioning all the while about the background of what happened in Barcelona, right? She's got this arm injury. She's been shot in the arm, and she's telling this guy, you know, wrap up my arm tight in a tourniquet while I drive and tell you about why I've carjacked you and what happened in Barcelona.
Right.
And I believe that this guy named Scott, the guy, this sort of wimpy guy that she kidnaps, is supposed to be a proxy for the audience. Essentially, he's the guy saying, what's going on, strong lady? And then she tells him everything. But, I mean, to me, that was a really... That was a really shitty proxy. Like, I want really a better proxy than that.
Yeah, like, Scott was like, weirdly zen about everything that was going on. If I was kept thinking to myself, if I had been Scott, if I had been sitting in, you know, Woodstock, New York, enjoying my, you know, morning waffle with my with my buddies, and all of a sudden I saw, A, like, a crazy Black Ops, you know, MMA-style fight in front of me, guns blazing, you know, someone gets shot, and then a woman... who has Gina Carano's physique, grabs me, throws me into my own car, and commands that I dress her wound, and then proceeds to tell me an incredible Shaggy Dog story about her you know, Black Ops work, I would be freaking out. I'd be trying to throw myself out of the car. He sort of calmly sits there. He's sort of, like, asking great questions about, you know, it's just like, what is this guy thinking? Like, why is he not trying to escape? Why is he not, you know, like, why is he not just, like, passing out from fear?
That whole frame story, I think it should have actually been played either more for laughs, because it was kind of, I mean, like, as you say, it's comically absurd that this would happen to someone. So the fact that it was still sort of half trying to be played for suspense,
right,
you know, but then throwing in a few laughs at Scott's expense just all seemed really weak to me.
I actually would say that this is something I want to talk about at the end of the podcast, but this is one place where the movie reminded me of The Limey, which is a Steven Soderbergh film also written by Lem Dobbs, who's a screenwriter here, and also a revenge plot. And in The Limey, Terrence Stamp plays the guy who's trying to seek revenge for the murder of his daughter. And he comes to the United States from England, and he ends up having a sort of sidekick who also sort of serves a purpose in sort of teasing out some important exposition. That sidekick's played by Luis Guzman, who's a great character actor, who's very funny, and his relationship with Terrence Stamp, which is a really oddball thing, this, like, Cockney Brit talking to this Hispanic guy, they have seemingly nothing in common, but more in common than you might think. That relationship is a central part of the movie, and it's one of the reasons the movie works so well. Whereas here, Scott is just this, like, goofy kid. We don't really know anything about him. We have no idea why he has so much poise under pressure.
And you add that to the fact that Gina Carano is no Terrence Stamp by a long shot, and it's not a rich relationship, the Scott-Mallory duo.
No, it's not.
Do you want to get to the end of the movie and the resonances with the Limey that you saw there?
Right. So just briefly, I guess, to spoil the ending, everything kind of ends up coming together where Mallory has a sort of forces a showdown at her father's home, and that's in New Mexico. That is where I think the New Mexico scenes happen. And she sort of knows that all the people who are chasing her know that she's going to go to New Mexico. Her dad is a weird character played by Bill Paxton. He I guess, is now an author of either sort of like military airport potboilers or maybe military history. I wasn't able to glean
whether he wrote fiction or nonfiction.
Yeah,
I was asking the same thing.
Yeah, I was like, I wasn't sure from the cover, the brief shot of the cover of the book, what kind of literature he wrote. But he also, I mean, I thought the suggestion was that he must be former military himself.
Don't they even say, I was a Marine? I think he says to her at one point, you were a Marine, I was a Marine.
Oh, okay.
Semper Fi, right? He signs the book to her, Semper Fi.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so he seems to kind of get like what she's doing and what she's up against. And so she kind of flees to his house.
Awesome house, by the way.
Awesome house. It's like kind of cool, like desert chalet sort of spot. And there's like and Ewan McGregor and Channing Tatum and a couple of other doofuses who they work with all go there to try to take out Mallory. And of course, Mallory sort of plays cat and mouse with them and essentially kills them off one by one. Except Ewan McGregor manages to escape. But then what?
It's also dark and murky what's happening there. I didn't know who shot who.
Ewan McGregor realizes that Channing Tatum is kind of like the scales are falling from his eyes, and he's really realizing that McGregor's in the wrong, and I think Channing Tatum had a soft spot for Mallory, and so he's sort of about to switch sides, and then he gets whacked by
I will say
McGregor.
That in comparison to the Mallory Caine character, Channing Tatum comes off as master thespian. It is one of the best roles I've seen him in.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I think it's probably only by comparison. So now I'm blanking. Ewan McGregor escapes. Mallory is not able to kill him in New Mexico. He goes to real Mexico and is like hiding out in like a beach town in Mexico and sort of decides to take a jog on the beach. And that's where Mallory ultimately tracks him down, right?
Right. So he's just walking on the beach, and there is something also comical about that moment where he thinks, oh, I couldn't be further removed from civilization, and then who should appear in skin-tight, black, you know, kick-ass gear than Mallory Caine
on
the beach.
And that was one moment, and there were several, where I felt like the movie was trying to be funny. Because the shot is framed, so you basically – you're watching Ewan McGregor look out to sea. He's sort of looking into the camera, and you're sort of – the camera's sort of hovering over the ocean, and he's sort of looking out into the water. And then in the background, all of a sudden, you see this little black spot, and they're like, oh, that's Gina Carano. And she's running towards him, and he's looking out to sea and doesn't hear her coming. But, like, the amount of time for which she is running, like, it's not – it's kind of goofy. Like, there's like, multiple seconds where you see her running, and he's not looking over his shoulder. Like, I actually thought it was kind of a comical – scene, like one that was almost making fun of the conventions of the action movie. Like, how could he not realize that she's coming? Like, how does he not hear the sand being kicked up by her boots?
That could have been. I mean, that was one of the other moments, as we were saying at the beginning, that I'm just not sure to what extent this is being played for laughs or not. And if it was going to be, I wish it would have just gone out there on a limb more and been a spoof of an action thriller.
Exactly. Like, it could have been a spoof of a sort of Bourne style, like, I'm impossible to kill movie, but I don't know. It didn't feel like it ever quite went that far in that direction, so that you kind of knew that's what's going on.
Maybe here. If you were an incredible connoisseur of you know, sort of B-grade action schlock movies, you would see more of what this movie's trying to do with them. I don't know. Because with the music at certain moments, I really didn't like the music in general. In general, I don't tend to like Soderbergh's music, actually. Yeah. He's a little too ambient for me, and he has to have music all the time. And this music was, to me, a little bit generic action music. But at times, I thought he did a funny thing where he would start it really suddenly. Almost, yeah, you know, the way that a Hong Kong movie or a porn movie will just suddenly throw a bunch of music at you to shift the mood.
Yeah, no, that's true. So anyway, McGregor and Mallory, they kind of get into like a fist fight. Ultimately, he's sort of running away from her through a series of rocks by the water, and he just like severely like twists his ankle between two rocks. Looks like he's broken his ankle, and he falls down, at which point he's
trapped in a tide pool, and the tide's coming in.
Yeah, and so at that point he delivers like another sort of long flashback piece of exposition in which he explains essentially everything that happened in the movie to Mallory and to us, the audience, clarifying some things, but not everything. I mean, it all kind of went by quickly. Some of the stuff we already sort of knew, other things.
Essentially, you get to see the bad guys behind the scene in his flashback, right? You see them rubbing their palms together and making their evil plans.
Exactly. But it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of a lot of exposition right at the very end of the movie. And, you know, some of those flashback scenes are okay. I like the scene between McGregor and Fassbender when they're like kind of making their plans. But, you know, it's sort of like, at that point, I almost didn't care what the details of the plot were.
Honestly, by the end of this movie, I was just sort of praying, let it end. And it's only a 92-minute movie. I mean, it should be
exactly
flying by at that speed. But what were the Limey parallels at the end? Because I haven't seen the Limey in so long.
So there were two things that struck me as being weirdly very similar to the ending of the Limey. And the first is that the Limey ends – this is obviously spoilers for people who haven't seen the Limey. The Limey also ends with the person who is seeking revenge, in that case Terrence Stamp, cornering all the bad guys in a beautiful house, beautiful isolated house. So there's like another kind of thing where you have all the bad guys in one house, and the revenge seeker is kind of playing around the edges and kind of taking them out one by one. So that was like a very direct parallel. And then the other parallel that's even weirder, I think, is that the Limey ends with the ostensible bad guy, Peter Fonda, running on the beach away from the revenge seeker, Terrence Stamp, and twisting his ankle in the rocks and falling and breaking his ankle. So it's like essentially the same exact coda, although in the Limey, Terrence Stamp basically decides not to kill Peter Fonda. He has this sort of realization that I won't get into it, but he decides not to kill Peter Fonda, whereas in Haywire, the strong suggestion is that Mallory leaves Ewan McGregor for dead. She's like, the tide's coming in, you clearly can't move, and she just walks away and kind of lets the ocean do the work for her.
Right, she gets her flashback and she takes off.
Yeah, whereas in the Limey, it's more a story about sort of Terrence Stamp's own sort of voyage of self-discovery, and he kind of realizes he doesn't need to exact this revenge that has so consumed him for years, which I think is a more interesting, you know, way of ending a picture. But it was strange to me that Lem Dobbs decided to have those, you know, such similar endings to these two movies, and yet the movies, I don't know, for me at least, are kind of worlds apart in terms of quality and execution. And I had this cockamamie theory that I wanted to share with the world, but it's probably not worthy of print. But I'll use the spoiler special to throw it out there. One crazy theory for what's going on in Haywire is that if people who are fans of The Limey know that the DVD of The Limey has this amazing commentary track where Lem Dobbs and Steven Soderbergh talk about the making of the movie. And Dobbs is like clearly like unhappy with a bunch of choices that Soderbergh made in terms of shooting the movie, in terms of kind of lopping off parts of the screenplay.
And they argue about it on the commentary
track? And they argue about it.
Oh, how great.
Yeah, it's one of the great commentary tracks on any DVD. And part of it, one of the reasons it's so great is that it's so contentious. And I don't know, watching The Limey and listening to the commentary track, to me it always seemed that Soderbergh made the right choice. Is it that Dobbs is kind of standing up for what he had on the page, but that Soderbergh kind of had a vision for the movie that was better than Dobbs's. And I sort of was laughing to myself walking out of Haywire thinking, what if what we just saw was sort of a 92-minute refutation of Lem Dobbs's position on the Limey commentary track? He's like, you think you were right? You think if I just shoot your script, it'll be a better movie? All right, I'll just shoot your script next time. We'll see which one's better. And I think it's pretty clear that Steven Soderbergh was right, that his approach in the Limey was the way to go, because Haywire just does not work as well. That's my theory.
I love it. I'm going to go with it because it answers all the questions I had about this movie. It's essentially it will just stand as, yes, it's a I told you so movie from,
yes.
from Soderbergh to Dobbs.
Right. Soderbergh is like just crazy enough that he might do something like that. I mean, he makes movies so like facilely that he'd be like, all right, whatever, I'll take 6 months just to prove Dobbs is
right.
Dobbs
he's so prolific he can afford to throw away one.
I've made all these great movies.
That.
No one's going to hold this one against me. I'll make another, you know. So. Anyway, I posit that. If he wants to make a sort of deathbed declaration, then that's what that movie was about. You know, years from now, I'll be vindicated. But I'm probably not right. It's probably just a movie that he kind of mailed in.
All right. Well, Soderbergh is prolific enough that we'll probably be sitting here within the next 6 months talking about another one of his movies. But thanks for coming with me to this one.
My pleasure. I look forward to that.
Our producer is Chris Wade. Our executive producer is Andy Bowers. And our editor is Melanie McAfee. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.